Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, the host of Politics Now, the ABC's podcast unpacking the latest political news when it happens. Every weekday, you'll hear me and the sharpest political minds at the ABC.
Me, Jacob Greber.
Me, Raph Epstein.
Me, Claudia Long.
Me, David Spears.
And me, Melissa Clark, in the chair for Fran Kelly for the Party Room every Thursday.
So join me for Politics Now, download and follow on the ABC Listen app.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, is it just a game of whack-a-mole? The government's impending social media ban for under-16s. There's now two new social media platforms that the kids are flocking to that could be part of the ban. So, have you heard of Lemon 8 and Yope?
If we find that because they've been logged out of Snapchat, Instagram, TikTok, what have you, they end up on Lemonade, then we will look at whether the harm has transferred there and whether we need to add them to the list.
It's interesting. I haven't heard of those two platforms either.
I have to tell you, I'm not young enough to know organically, so I've had to learn myself.
We'll have more on that shortly. Then we'll head to Asia, where millions have been affected by widespread floods. We'll get a sense of the chaos in Sri Lanka.
The mood in Sri Lanka is both somber and one of resilience. The floodwaters have not receded completely and the full extent of the damage is laid bare.
That account coming from Colombo later on. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. All right, be honest. Have you ever heard of Yope or Lemon 8? I'm not saying lemonade, that's lemon with an eight at the end. Apparently these are two new social media platforms that are all the rage, so much so that they've jumped up in the rankings on the Apple and Google app platforms. The government seems to be worried that kids are heading there to skirt around the social media ban coming in next week. And Lemon 8 seems to be capitalising on that. It's been advertising on TikTok that it's not part of the ban and suggesting kids could go there instead. Now, the eSafety Commissioner has written to both platforms recommending they self-assess to determine if they fall under these new laws that begin next Wednesday. The High Court, meanwhile, is considering a last-minute legal challenge to these laws as bureaucrats dismiss concerns that the ban will further isolate vulnerable young people. Someone who's across the law and has been getting across these new platforms is Lizzie O'Shea. She's a lawyer and chairs the group Digital Rights Watch. Here's her interview with Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast.
Now, I'm not young enough or cool enough to know much about these platforms, Lemonade and Yope. Tell me about how they work.
I have to tell you, I'm not young enough to know organically, so I've had to learn myself. But so the issue is that there's a list of social media apps that the government has indicated come within the scope of the ban. But there is, you know, a definition that is designed to be flexible. There's an exclusions for messaging and gaming, but otherwise some of the criteria was covered in your news story earlier. It includes things as to whether you share content with friends and whether you can be contacted by people. And so there's a question about whether some of these other apps that do similar things that might look a bit more like, say, a messaging app in the case of Yope, come within scope. And these apps have become extremely popular in recent times, moving up the ranks of Australia's most popular apps very quickly in the last week or so, with the suspicion being that it's because young people are seeing this as an alternative when they get booted off some of these platforms as a result of the social media ban. So what the government's done is said, you know, these apps need to self-assess. They're expecting companies to assess whether they come within scope, which does highlight, I think, some of the operational challenges with this kind of policy, where what constitutes an app within scope remains unclear and is going to be a matter of adding to that list over time, I expect, as this situation changes with the implementation of the policy.
So we're likely to see this again and again as kids are migrating from one platform to another. I'm imagining slightly ahead of the politicians.
Yeah, well, you know, at one point, I think it was Annika Wells talked about if LinkedIn became a place where young people congregated, she might have to consider putting it in the list, which I think is a slightly implausible outcome, but may occur, of course. But there is this idea that I think different kinds of applications might be brought within scope because they meet the criteria. There is also a number of apps that were considered early on as being potentially in scope. Something like Wikipedia couldn't get clarity early on in this phase of the policy to work out whether they were in scope. And I think that's an interesting suggestion. Maybe there will be other applications that the people think should be within scope, and the government comes under political pressure to include them, even if that wasn't the original intention. So I think there is going to be a lot of movement with this policy because it's so public, it's so contentious, it's been debated and discussed for such a long time that people's expectations may also mean that it shifts.
The ABC's TV program Behind the News for young people asked more than 17,000 of its young viewers about the social media ban. 75% said they won't stop using social media next week. Does that illustrate the difficulties that the government faces here, Lizzie?
I think so. And a lot of them talked about how they thought it was going to be ineffective, which I think is interesting. Young people, anyone who's got young people living with them knows that they're very good at getting around certain kinds of rules that you might put in place. So this is an example of young people talking about the fact that they intend to continue using social media, but also that they're not convinced it's going to be effective. I think what has been missing in this conversation, unfortunately, is the voice of young people. A lot of young people actually, I think, support and understand the mission behind this policy. They don't all love social media, and if you look at other polling, they do have concerns about it. They want it to be better and safer. But I think it's also really important to talk to them about where they're at, and a lot of them intend to continue using the social media services, looking at workarounds. And there's a real question there around how the government can make these services safer, not just prohibit access, which can create other problems in terms of how young people then experience apps that aren't designed for them at all.
Lizzie, tell me about this High Court case. So Libertarian New South Wales Upper House member John Ruddick has taken his fight against these laws to the High Court with two 15-year-olds named as plaintiffs. Mm. Is that likely to go anywhere?
Well, this is a difficult question, right? Australia has very few rights in its legal system. We don't have an enforceable human rights regime. We have some rights contained in the Constitution, as many people know, so an implied right of freedom of political communication, so it's implied into the Constitution. And it's really been interpreted as being about access to politicians, representatives, so facilitating social democracy rather than a more independent right that you might see in other parts of the world, like in the United States or in Europe. So I think there's a bit of a question here around whether this ban falls within scope of that implied right of freedom of political communication in circumstances where young people don't have the right to vote or formally participate in social democracy. But there is a question here, right? A lot of young people use these platforms for working out what they think about political issues, for seeing how politicians communicate. You know, one of the rumours flying around is that there's a plan to unfollow Anthony Albanese from social media on the day this ban comes into place because of concerns around this policy. So a lot of young people track our democracy and work out what they think about politics through social media, and I think that should be acknowledged, which I think is a potential positive contribution or way in which people use it. And so there is a question as to whether then this is brought within the scope of that implied right of freedom of political communication. Look, let's see. I'm not convinced it's going to work, but I'm not the High Court and I don't have to be convinced of it.
You were just listening to Lizzie O'Shea, a lawyer and the chair of the group Digital Rights Watch, speaking to Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. We will have more on this story across the next couple of weeks. Well, heading to Asia, where more than 1,300 people have now been killed and hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced by devastating flooding and landslides across four countries. Sri Lanka, Indonesia, Thailand and Malaysia have been battered by tropical cyclones and heavy monsoon rains. It's submerged whole towns, destroyed key transport routes and cut off vital water and electricity. Sri Lanka is one of the countries hardest hit by these systems. There are more than 450 people dead and 100,000 forced to evacuate to emergency shelters. The time difference makes hearing from voices in Sri Lanka a pretty tricky task for a breakfast show. So thanks to people like Bismarck Swangan at UNICEF in Colombo, who stayed up pretty late for us, we've been able to hear just what's happening on the ground.
If the mood in Sri Lanka is both somber and one of resilience, because Sri Lanka is a country with a solidarity that enables it to withstand and bounce back during such difficult moments. Although the cyclone that hit Sri Lanka on the morning of Saturday, the 28th of November, and turned what was supposed to be a beautiful weekend for families into a disaster, that storm has gone away. But the consequences of the storm are what we are seeing on the ground. There are still people who are displaced. The damage to infrastructure, including houses, roads, bridges, telephone networks, has been extensive. And so the floodwaters have not receded completely, and that's really what the situation is like on the ground.
People have been comparing this to the disaster of the 2004 tsunami. Is that the scale of damage that we're looking at in some areas?
The numbers really keep changing from time to time as access improves, as communication is being restored. For example, the latest figures on the number of people who have died so far has almost increased by about 50 from the figure that was released about 24 hours ago. So the latest figure is 465 people now confirmed dead. And therefore, even when the water is receding, supposedly the situation should be improving. But that also means that the full extent of the damage and impact of this disaster is laid bare. We have heard of reports of bodies being discovered. There are still people who are inaccessible and cannot be contacted because telephone lines do not work or the roads do not work. And so it is really a crisis of unprecedented scale. We don't know what the damage will look like exactly in the days ahead once access across the country is restored.
Authorities in Sri Lanka say that there are fears that the scale of the death toll from this disaster could rise, as you're saying. What are the areas of the country that are worst affected?
So the eastern province, which is to the eastern side of the coastal part of Sri Lanka, where the cyclone landed, the central province and part of the Uva province. These are some of the areas, and the western province, of course, where Colombo is. These are some of the areas that have been the hardest hit with the flooding, as well as the landslides that has caused the enormous devastation that we are talking about.
And Bismarck, what are the concerns from UNICEF's perspective regarding children who have been affected by this disaster?
The latest figures from the Disaster Management Center says over 1.5 million people are affected. We estimate initially that over 275,000 of them are children. And their access to food, many of them are displaced from the comfort of their homes to centers that are overcrowded. The emotional distress that they are subjected to. There is a lot of water in the country, but it is not clean water. And that, for us, raises the risk of diseases for children.
Is there much foreign aid coming in as yet into Sri Lanka?
So far, as UNICEF, we haven't received any much aid that has come in through us. We know that the government has appealed for international assistance. And all I can say really is that if anybody wants to stand with Sri Lanka now, this is the time to help Sri Lanka.
In Colombo, that is Bismarck Swanken, who works for UNICEF in Sri Lanka. Right, so marathon talks in Moscow have ended this morning between American officials and the Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Kremlin is describing them as useful, constructive and meaningful. It says American negotiators will now return to the States and present their findings to Donald Trump and will then get back to Moscow. Ukraine will also be waiting to hear how the talks went. But early this morning, there were comments from the Russian leader that turned heads. Vladimir Putin walked into these talks with American officials moments after saying that if Europe wants war, he's ready. Now, these talks follow a fortnight of pretty intense diplomacy after the leaking of an American plan for Ukraine that critics say heavily favoured Moscow. So Europe has been offering counter-proposals. And while criticising that, the president, Vladimir Putin, ramped up his rhetoric.
We are not planning to fight Europe. I've said this 100 times. But if Europe suddenly decides to wage war against us and starts it, we are ready right now. If Europe chooses to start a war, the situation can very quickly reach a point where there will be no one left for us to negotiate with.
That is the Russian President Vladimir Putin speaking before that meeting in Moscow with American officials. Well, Russia analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Maria Snegovaya, gave Sally her read of those comments.
I think it's quite consistent with what we have heard from Putin before. Say what you want about the Russian leadership, but there is a degree of continuity in their statements. We see that Russia keeps pushing forward on the front line in Ukraine, unfortunately for Ukraine, gaining some ground, even if slowly. And it continues to strike deeply into Ukraine, altogether showing no sign of a willingness to seriously negotiate peace agreements, especially now that it's actually feeling like it has having advantage on the battlefield. And Putin keeps referencing the original causes of this crisis, quote unquote, basically referring to his revisionist intent vis-a-vis the international security, not just Ukraine. From that perspective, I do not think it's very likely that he's be willing to seriously make certain concessions to Ukraine to push forward the successful negotiations agreement. And it's very likely that we'll see this yet another round of peace negotiations collapse like we've seen before over the last 9 months.
Does the United States really have any leverage when it comes to dealing with Russia right now, Maria?
Definitely in terms of the intensifying sanctions, we have seen some promising signs with the sanctions announced on Rosneft and Lukoil, the Russian oil producing companies that together handle about 50% of Russia's crude oil. And the key question is about the secondary sanctions, because Russia's economic situation is not so bright at the moment. There is evidence, multiplying signs of looming a recession and potentially pushing forward the reduction in Russia's energy revenue will deliver a blow to Russian economy, making it harder to sustain its war against Ukraine, even if we are far from, it will take some time. On top of that, the U.S. could continue supplying Ukraine with weapons, something, unfortunately, that has been consistently an issue over the last year, but potentially reinforcing Ukraine's ground will make it harder for Russia to keep pushing forward and accordingly reduce Putin's negotiation stances and make it likely to make him more willing to negotiate, but all of that will not take place momentarily. All of that will take time. It will require commitment and unity from the transatlantic alliance that has been crumbling, unfortunately, recently. And altogether, Putin, as of now, seems to be convinced that he will outlast the West.
Maria, Russian forces say they've captured the eastern Ukrainian city of Poprovsk, a claim that's being called over-exaggerated by a Ukrainian MP. Does that battle have any significant impact on the current peace talks?
Well, listening to military analysts like Michael Kaufman, they say that obviously Ukraine's situation is not ideal. At the moment, it's clear that they're losing ground, but it's happening very slow. The battle altogether, the front line, is not collapsing. And while the loss of Pokrovsk is probably unavoidable at this point, it's not going to be a major blow to Ukraine's strategic and defense positions altogether. So while altogether it's clear that Russia is having an advantage, it's not radically, the current situation is not radically altering the broader long-term posture of Ukraine. And that's important to keep up the morale and keep fighting, because unfortunately, as we discussed before, Russia's revisionist intent will probably remain as such. And so it's very important to keep defending its ground. In fact, according to some analysts, Ukraine's positions, despite the observed situation on the ground, have actually improved compared to 2024, because they somewhat addressed some of the manpower situation that they had before. So it's not ideal. We also have the scandal, corruption scandal inside of Ukraine that certainly is further sort of breaking the unity and undermining its positions in the West. But it's far from being abysmal, and more or less the broader like strategic situation remains unchanged.
And that is a Russia analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Maria Snegovaya. When it comes to Ukraine, there's really not a lot of optimism around these talks in Moscow. Here's what we heard earlier this morning from one former Ukrainian minister, Oleh Rybachuk.
Ukrainians are asking themselves, what's the point? How many circles you have to make to come to conclusion that actually Putin, as Trump says, is not willing to conclude the peace. Practically everybody in Ukraine is positive that Russia will not agree, even to the best for them plan, which was disastrous for Ukraine, these 28 points. Putin is always saying no.
And that is former Ukrainian Minister Oleh Rybachuk there. You can hear more coverage of this story right across ABC platforms today. Yesterday, we looked at the government's new artificial intelligence guidelines and specifically questioned this idea that Australia should become a global leader in hosting data centres. But what exactly are they? And why is there so much scrutiny around how much energy and water they use? Belinda Dennett is the Chief Executive of Data Centres Australia. It's a newly formed peak body representing this sector. And she came on to explain.
So we have around 350 data centres in Australia. Majority are the urban fringe of Melbourne and Sydney, but we also have data centres across every state and territory in Australia, providing the digital services that we as Australians use every day.
So we're hearing a lot about data centres in the current political debates around AI and also environmental sustainability. But the absolute basics, what do they look like? If you're driving past a data centre, what does it look like?
So they're large buildings, usually fairly nondescript. They tend not to have a lot of signage or flag posting what they are. They perhaps look like a warehouse, but they are highly technical, state-of-the-art innovation buildings that house the computers that run all the services, whether you're using Netflix or Spotify, whether you're sending emails, doing your banking online. That's where all the power happens, the computing, the processing. So people talk about the cloud. The cloud isn't actually up in the sky. It's in these big facilities running the computers that really drive our digital transformation of our economy.
So we could be driving past these things every day and not realise that that's what's there.
Yeah, pretty much. And if you head out in Western Melbourne or Western Sydney, that's predominantly where these facilities are, and they go about their business and you've probably never known about it.
So we've heard a lot of discussion on the environmental front about the use of electricity and water. How much power and water do some of these centres use in an average year or quarter?
Yeah. Well, look, first of all, make the point that data centres aggregate the energy use of our computing across the digital economy. So where once, you know, that energy use sat on your home bill or on the office bill, it now gets aggregated into the data center play, and that's why we're noticing it. We've never really calculated the energy use of the digital economy, and when you think there's still some 80% of compute that sits in the basements of office buildings, within office buildings, and we don't really calculate that energy use. It's kind of an invisible load. As we move that into data centres, which are far more energy efficient, 67% more energy efficient than on-prem servers in office buildings, we're seeing that aggregation, and that's what's setting people off of, look at this energy use. Well, that's kind of the byproduct of digital transformation of your economy, that we are using more digital services.
And that is Belinda Dennett, the Chief Executive of Data Centres Australia, this newly formed peak body representing the sector. Thank you very much for listening to The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Sally Sara, produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Josie Asher. I'm Luke Sidham-Dunton. We'll be back in your ears, same time, same place, 11:30 on Radio National, a little bit earlier if you're listening to us on the ABC Listen app. Have a good day, and we'll see you tomorrow.